You're tuned to KHSU, and you've got Art Waves. I'm Wendy Butler. Thank you so much for tuning in. I've got two interviews on the program today. Later, we'll hear from Doc Stull. He'll be presenting a performance of stories backed by live music this Friday, November 16th at 7 p.m. at West Haven Center for the Arts. His show, inspired by and compiled from his international travels, is titled The Nicaraguan, Bolivian, and Cuban Diaries. Doc Stull, later on Art Waves. First today, Del Arte International presents Bird of the Inner Eye, Joan Shirley's readings of painter Morris Graves' letters. The letters are taken from Selected Letters of Morris Graves, edited by Vicki Halper and Lawrence Fong, and published in 2013. Shirley's presentation will also include material from interviews with contemporaries of the artist. And she will be backed by Del Arte company members and local actors and dance improvisations by choreographer and Del Arte faculty member Lara Munoz. The show, which takes its title from one of Graves's paintings, will take place at three venues: Del Arte's Carlo Theater, Thursday, November 15th, Eureka's Black Fawn Gallery, Saturday, November 17th, and at the Arcata Playhouse, Sunday, November 25th, all shows at 7 p.m. with admission by donation. Joan Shirley spent some time with me last Friday in the KHSU studio. She begins the interview by reading an excerpt of one of Morris Graves' letters.
I went to the commanding officer and said, I could not celebrate the birth of Christ in an army camp. And he was so flabbergasted that he signed the pass, and I was gone in 5 minutes. I came back on the bus and walked into this drunken barracks at 6 o'clock last night, no one even noticing that I was a day late. This morning I talked casually with the first sergeant, and he had been drinking all Christmas Day and apparently didn't notice my absence. Nothing would have happened even if he had been aware of it, for he too thinks I am beyond hope. Well, now, here's my good news. This morning, one of the clerks who works at headquarters office told me yesterday, Christmas, the commanding general had sent this teletype message just to Washington, D.C., quote, recommend discharge of Morris Graves without further hearing, end quote. If only Washington, D.C. answers by teletype, I could be out of here. Well, in a month, anyway. It's reaching the point of obsession with me, and this is not good. So I will turn again with patience and remember that discharge is an incidental only, and I'll try to reclaim more enduring thoughts. If a man lives quietly, he can receive good or dark news and take it into himself and deeply consider its meaning and its reasons and its bearing upon his life. But if a man is in a barracks with 75 confused and near desperate surface men and receives dark news, then it's like being at a carnival and on being told of a death of a friend saying, I will ward off sorrow by buying more and more rides on the merry-go-round. This does not heal him, but cheapens him in his heart. And what I try to say is that inside I am as if my feeling instruments had gotten all their wires crossed. And if I, who've had easy trouble, feel this way, what must a fighting hatred and total war blasphemy and defiance do to a man? For these days will leave deep scars, even though God holds us by our right hand. God have mercy on Europe and on Asia. Love for now, Morris.
Well, let me ask you this. Who was he writing this letter to?
That was to his mother, to Helen Graves. And that was from Camp Roberts on December 26th, 1942. He had a very long and deep correspondence with his mother, as well as with his dealer, Marion Willard. Okay, and then let me skip to... How did I meet Morris? Oh, God, I'll never forget it. He had invited the painter Richard Gilkey to bring me out, and he was just finishing a house at Woodway Park in Edmonds, Washington. It was called Kerladen. It was snowing, and it was night. And we went out, and he had just gotten this enormous stone that weighed tons and tons and tons, and he was looking at it. It was the most beautiful, great, great Japanese-type stone. And he had just had it delivered, which was a terrible job. You can imagine what... And we got to the door, and out stormed this man, 6 foot and whatever he is, 6'4". He is enormously tall and very thin, and he had this great candelabra. It was like a Russian movie. He had a great candelabra in his hand, blazing candles. Well, there were no outdoor lights yet, and it was snowing. And we went out, and he put the candelabra, it must have had 10 or 12 candles on it, on this enormous stone that had the snow and the ledges all white. And here was this devastatingly beautiful man standing behind it with his eyes flashing. Well, you know, but he affects everyone like that. He's absolutely hypnotic. He's a mystic, but there's the other side of the coin. For everything about him, just about the opposite can be said is true, you know. I mean, the way he wants, well, how he wants to be Gandhi and live like Gandhi with just a pair of sandals and nothing. And the other half wants to live like Frederick II.
And you said this was an...
This is Jan Thompson, who was a lifelong friend of Morris and who he met when he was living in Seattle. And she practically saved his life once after he had moved to Ireland and was extremely ill. And she just was part of his life for a very long time. And he was very generous. He gave her a painting, which helped her to buy a house. She never had a lot of money. She was kind of a free spirit, rode around Europe on a motorbike. And
did you have a chance to speak to her?
No, she died. She was 90 when she died, probably at least 10 or so years ago. Pretty much everyone who is letters I'm reading in this has been dead quite a while. Even the most recent people, except, of course, Robert Yarber, who's still one of the directors of the Morris Graves Foundation, and whom, with his wife Desiree, I believe are going to be at the reading at Del Arte. So they'll be there to answer some questions as well about Morris.
Oh, so will there be like a formal question-answer following the reading?
Yeah, although the whole thing is kind of informal in a way, like a happening. You know, there's improvised dance, there's going to be projections of some of the paintings. It's a sort of different format than I've ever done, trying to put together a reading that's not just a lecture or kind of dry reading, but to actually have actors read and try to personify these people.
I want to know why you were so intrigued by these letters and wanted to make them a centerpiece of a performance of this type.
I feel like the letters show Morris Graves in an entirely different light than his paintings. He talked about, and I don't have that right here, but he talked about painting as a visual language and that he didn't like to talk about his painting. And he speaks of having at one time spoken about his paintings and then been embarrassed about it later. And didn't want to be quoted when people said, why do you paint? But his writings to me are these very, very passionate statements of a person who deeply feels. And these are letters I'm told that he often rewrote. And I came across some of that in the archives where I would see things crossed out and rewritten and an attempt to find a more poetic way of saying something. So, you know, he's writing at a time when people actually paid attention to their correspondence. It was a thing you did. You communicated with your friends and your family, or people asked you to write to them. And so I thought that his letters showed a voice that I didn't necessarily see in the paintings, but when I start looking at them together, they're just a different side of the same person. And because they are so You know, he was a really dramatic character, very theatrical. He had this great sense of humor and mischief, and there's some famous stories about the sort of happenings he staged when he lived in the Northwest. And so, like she said, like Jan Thompson said, there's two sides, more than two sides, really. But in the letters, there is this very poetic, very dramatic, very theatrical way of writing, which is what made me think, gee, these could be set to music if I can figure out a way to make it not a bio piece, but a work that shows something about his relationships or his feelings that are not just the tortured artist speaks. In trying to frame the letters in reading and look at what a structure could be, I feel like Morris was very aware of himself as an artist and believed that an artist had a role to play. And he says here in one of his letters, this is one to a friend, Betty Willis, "During these long months, the Army has thrown in my face its own utter blindness by telling me that as an artist, a man is a joke. I am of value to them only to serve the crime of war." And one of the reasons that I have always been attracted to Graves' paintings and his philosophy is his thoughts about beauty. And beauty seems to me one of those things that can so easily be lost as a value as we look at the world as it's becoming. Of course, on the one side, the greed, the power, the hatred. And on the other side, the resistance and how we steel ourselves, how we move ourselves forward. But here's what he says. This is another letter from Camp Roberts to his dealer, Marion. He had a great correspondence with her. "I should not condemn these men that I am packed in with for falling back totally upon the flesh. I should not sit here on my bunk and curse their darkness. I should use beauty as an opiate. And if I can pull it out of nature and hint at it with paint, then I should, and hand it as an opiate to any who will have it." To think of beauty as an opiate instead of an opioid or some as drug, even if more kids could be taught that there is solace, that there is excitement, etc. I don't know. I know that as an artist, I probably think more about beauty than a lot of people, but I don't see how anyone can possibly spend time in nature and not be moved by its beauty as well as the other aspects.
And you title your performance after the title of one of his paintings, A Bird of the Inner Eye. And so bird, yeah, I wanted you to talk about what that symbol means for you. I mean, there's been pieces written about what it means, and he's spoken. Morris Graves has spoken about what it means for him. What does it mean for you?
I love birds. Today, I was out at the river. I walk three times a week on the Mad River, and I saw an osprey, stared at it for a long time. It was sitting in a tree, and then it flew away. I think that the bird that I relate to and what he talks about is the soul, in a way, the part of ourselves that is looking for light, is looking for God, if you will. And when I say God, I equate that with what is unknown, not with a person. And so in his studies of birds, what is wonderful about them is that they were observed in life. They were not imaginary birds, that he was surrounded by birds. He grew up with chickens and he grew up with wild birds around in his life growing up as a kid. And so it was not an imagination only that gave him his images of birds, but in a painting like Bird Experiencing Light, which is one of his most famous paintings. It's not only, I think, slightly humorous image of this wonderful tufted bird blinking almost in the beauty of the light, but it is what happens when we start to open up our minds and actually see that the world is bigger than we are, that we have a connection to a great, great spirit.
Joan Shirley, Bird of the Inner Eye. Joan Shirley's readings of painter Morris Graves' letters and also material from interviews with contemporaries of the artist. And the event includes Del Arte Company members, local actors, and dance improvisations created by Lara Munoz. The shows are at Del Arte's Carlo Theater this Thursday, November 15th, Eureka's Black Fawn Gallery, Saturday, November 17th, and at the Arcata Playhouse, Sunday, November 25th. All shows at 7 p.m., with admission by donation. For tickets and information for the Carlo Theater show, visit delarte.com. And for the Black Fawn Gallery and Playhouse shows, you can email info@delarte.com. I'm Wendy Butler, and this is Art Waves on KHSU. Doc Stahl presents The Nicaraguan, Bolivian, and Cuban Diaries, a Latin jazz-infused show in which he'll deliver stories and poetry about his adventures and reflections, and all this backed by live music, courtesy of the RLA Trio. The event is this Friday, November 16th, at 7 p.m. at the West Haven Center for the Arts. Doc Stahl is a longtime KHSU contributing host and commentator, but it's been several years since he's given a theatrical performance.
Well, I'm telling stories all the time, as you probably know, Wendy. But yeah, 4 years ago, I did a show with Tim Randles, who's going to be accompanying me in West Haven on the 16th. But yeah, this is going to be a really fun show. And Tim and I actually go back, our wonderful composer, piano player, in 20 years. We did things at the Jambalaya, and we did things at Tomo's and the Avalon, no longer the Avalon, but many, many, many places. So we've got a long history of collaborating together.
And he's a keyboardist?
He's a keyboardist, and I also wrote 75 shows for the local ESPN sports affiliate, and Tim did the original music for every one of the shows. So if it had a Latin theme, he would put that in. If it had kind of an Arabic theme, he'd put that in. So he's tremendous composer, and he's really the musician's musician. And so it's really fun to collaborate because he enjoys the spoken word aspect and putting that whole thing together behind it.
Now, it's not just going to be Tim, though. It's Tim along with his RLA trio.
Right. A couple of guys that I know and one person I don't know, Mike LeBoule. I've collaborated with him for the last 20 years, kind of the sensitive man's Elvin Jones drummer. I mean, in the shows that I've worked with Mike, when I listen to the shows in retrospect, I hear all kinds of really clever things he does with the drums, and I really enjoy working with him. Ken Lawrence, I've known him forever, one of the great bassists in town, kind of a humble county treasure himself. John Lewis, percussionist, I've seen him many times, but I've never worked with him. So I'm looking forward to that. And then we have a saxophonist. I don't have his name in front of me, but I'm really excited about that. So we've got some really great backup people.
Yeah. And why is it called a trio then?
Well, I think generally that's kind of the skeletal base, but we've added some people onto that.
So. Oh, okay, marvelous. And so let's, as far as the music goes, let's start there then, or let's continue there. Will the music be accompanying your words the entire time?
Pretty much. So the concept of the show is called the Nicaraguan, Bolivian, Cuban Diaries. And in the last couple of years, I wanted to go to kind of some rough elbowed kind of adventurous spots. And so I had some amazing adventures there. They're really terrific. And so it's going to be Latin themed. We might have kind of the Bolivian Andean kind of mountainous theme in the Bolivian part, and kind of the straight ahead great Afro-Cuban rhythms for the Cuban part. And the Nicaraguan will be kind of an eclectic thing. But in all of these, yes, my storytelling will be accompanied by these terrific jazz musicians.
Let's talk about adventures. I want to go back to that, and then from there to the type of stories or poems you'll be telling but adventures. Tell about an adventure and tell where it happened and when it happened, what you remember of it.
Right. Well, this whole thing started pretty early, when I was growing up. I think my mother was kind of a caged hippie, kind of a caged Victorian, and wanted to imprint me to have adventures. So she would read me stories by Jack London and Thor Heyerdahl and Richard Halliburton. And I think she was imprinting me early on. And I can even remember in the seventh grade, my best buddy Marsh, you know, we were riding our 10 speeds to Mr. Flesher's science class. And I said, Marsh, we're in Palo Alto at the time. I said, let's just turn around and ride our bikes up Skyline Boulevard and ride across the Golden Gate Bridge. And he was like the best buddy you could ever have, because if you'd made it exciting, you could sell him on it. And we did it. And so I always had that kind of mindset for adventure. And after my freshman year at UC San Diego, I went to Europe and traveled to 20 different countries and went to the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War and went above the Polar Circle and, you know, went to East Jerusalem and Turkey and traveled a lot. So this was before I was even 20 years old. And then there was kind of a 40-year hiatus after that where, you know, I went back to school and I got 3 degrees and raised a family. And so 3 years ago, when I retired early from the university, I said, you know, I think I need to get back in the game.
And why?
Why?
Why is travel so important to you?
I think because you're always living in the moment. It's like, if you live in the moment, you can live forever. It's like immortality. And I think that's what travel does to people. It takes them out of themselves, and you're in a new environment, and there's really nothing like it. And the thing I like the most about it was simply the serendipity of it. The fact that you could get on a bus or get on a train or walk through the market, and you had no idea whom you would meet, what you would talk about, or where your life could potentially turn based upon one small interaction. And that's the thing I loved about travel. And so I had not ever been to Central America or Latin America before. And Nicaragua actually is the second poorest country in the whole Western Hemisphere. And yet I knew a lot about Nicaragua growing up for a lot of different reasons, which I'll share in the show. And I felt like I knew their poetry, and I felt like I knew their music, and I felt like I knew their history. So I was almost in character before I got there. And it was wonderful. And I felt the same way about Bolivia. You know, Bolivia, who goes to Bolivia? And it was fantastic. It was so different and exotic. And I thought, sure, I could go all kinds of places, but who goes to Bolivia? Now, I met one American in 3 months when I was there. And so it was really a great adventure. And then Cuba, of course, that was kind of the capper. All completely different but wonderful experiences.
In this show that you're giving,
right,
are you going to be doing poetry and stories? I mean, what are we going to be seeing and hearing?
Well, I want to leave a little out there to entice people, but trust me, you're going to get a little history, a little music, a little literature, some poetry, and some amazing music, and some travelogue with some self-reflection. And you'll get the same with Bolivia, and you'll get the same with Cuba. I'm syncing this up with the band. There's going to be a lot of call and response things too, like spontaneous things that I do, because I know these guys. And particularly like with the Cuba thing, there's lots of great percussion. So you can do some great call and response thing between the conga and the drums and whatever. So there's a lot of room for improv, and I'm not playing an instrument, but my voice and my storytelling that's my instrument. And so it's just a privilege to be with these musicians.
In writing, well, first of all, how much writing have you done that is leading up to this performance? I mean, are we talking years of keeping diaries, journals of some type?
Well, you know, we go back a long way and have performed together and done poetry together. And yes, I do think like a writer. So even the smallest interactions that happen, sometimes in retrospect, when you reflect, you go, oh my God, that little guy that I bought the beer from and that we exchanged money behind that iron cage, you know, in León, Nicaragua, and we shared the fact that we both knew the poetry of Rubén Darío, and we would try to impress each other by how much we knew. And just that little interaction in retrospect was amazing, because here was a shopkeeper who was barely eking out a living, and the rock star idol of Nicaragua was this poet, Rubén Darío. He was more important than any baseball player, more important than any politician. What country could you meet anybody, even people who were barely literate, who somehow knew this poet? That's a totally unique thing. And in retrospect, when you come back and you think, wow, that's different. That's really neat. You have a myriad of potential stories to write about. And what I tend to write about are just the human stories like that, about the people you meet, you know, the difference in the landscape and the history. But I think it's the people you meet. It's like you pick up little bits of God everywhere, you know, in the human heart. And that's another one of the things about travel that makes things so beautiful, is that wherever you go, the common denominators, we're the same species and we share the same DNA and the same worries about family and ourselves and our health and whatever. And so ultimately the beauty of travel is you're part of the human family, even though you have different cultural and religious backgrounds.
Doc Stahl. He'll perform his Nicaraguan, Bolivian, and Cuban diaries, the performance featuring live music by the RLA Trio, this Friday, November 16th at 7 p.m. at the West Haven Center for the Arts. Sliding scale admission. For more information, you can visit westhavencenter.org. That's all the time we have today. Art Waves is broadcast each Tuesday at 1:30 p.m., available anytime at khsu.org, and podcasts of this program are available for download from iTunes. Until next time, I'm Wendy Butler. Thank you for listening.